Accession number 20456, Reel 7.
Brigadier Wilson, Reel 7.
Could you explain the particular difficulties of operating wireless and other communication systems in jungle that you explored at Ahmednagar?
Well, we didn't actually explore that much at Ahmednagar, because Ahmednagar was reasonably flat and open. So we went down a bit further south to Belgaum, and Marbleshwar, which was both hilly and wooded. And we found that there were an enormous amount of blank areas. And if you didn't take the trouble to set your aerials and sets in the right place, the 9 and 11 sets were not strong enough to really give you good communications, particularly at night, when you've got, as darkness fell, you've got all sorts of interference from outside, which says what. We also, 6th Brigade had been detached from the division in, let me think, January 1943 to go to the Arakan under 14th Indian Division, then commanded by General Lloyd, who had, I think, God knows how many brigades under him, but no corps headquarters or other division headquarters to help him. And there was an unfortunate offensive down to take Akiab that was well and truly smashed by a certain Colonel Tanahashi of the Japanese Army. And as a result of 6th Brigade's tore up there, we also learned a very great deal more about the use of our wireless sets, which did not give anything like the sort of performance that we'd been accustomed to, or they had been accustomed to, in the UK. What you've got to realize was that I never really saw my first wireless set at battalion level until I joined 2nd Division in 1942. We had none at battalion level in Singapore. We had communications from brigade to battalion by wireless, brigade to division, but as far as the actual battalion and company sets are concerned, we had nothing. So one was learning oneself from scratch.
You say that to make the sets operate, you had to choose the right spot. How could you recognize the right sort of spot or the wrong sort of spot to position a wireless in the jungle?
Basically by moving around. If you could get on a bit of highest ground, and your other sets were on bits of highest ground, there was obviously some means of almost visual line of sight communication, in which case your sets would work. And our signals tried everything. They tried bouncing waves, or whatever, but that's all right for longer range stuff. It's no good for the short range stuff. And it really was a question of trial and error.
Were there any technical modifications that could be made, such as to the lengths of aerials or anything of that sort, that might have improved performance?
No. The first time I saw technically modified aerials was 5 years later when we went to Korea, and they produced all sorts of lovely spider aerials for the sets we had then.
What other means of communication could you employ in jungle conditions?
Line. As you advanced, your signal detachment had rolls of cable, and you stuck your earth pin from your set in from the bonfire telephone, and providing the line was okay, you could get through. And we used a lot of line, and of course, but that was vulnerable.
Vulnerable to what?
Well, first of all, to being trampled on by feet, or, you know, on the side of the track, trees falling down, shell fire, mules, you know, anything, Japanese patrols.
Did you normally lay it directly on the floor of the jungle, or did the signals wrap it around trees or other?
Well, you tried to wrap it around trees, but an awful lot of it, of course, ended up on the floor. Yeah.
Did you learn other lessons from the 6th Brigade when it came back from the Arakan?
Oh, yes.
Japanese?
For the first time, we learned, which we have not seen before, the incredible sighting of their defences and their use of local materials to make these very strong pillboxes, and which were shellproof, mortarproof, and indeed jolly nearly proof against anti-tank guns and tank guns. And that we have not come across before. And also the incredible use of camouflage. You very seldom saw Japanese move by day. He's always stuff at night, and that was what we had to get used to.
What were the local materials that they found appropriate?
Wood, bits of buildings, palm trees, anything. When we took Kohima Ridge, we were absolutely astounded at what they had used to line their bunkers really is the right word with. And they were extremely well concealed. And one of the things we taught ourselves to make were what we call pole charges. You had a great bit of gelignite at the end of a 12-foot pole with a quick-release igniter, and you shove this pole, hopefully, through the slit of the pillbox, pulled the igniter, and blew the thing up. It was a very effective toy.
Were the Japanese bunkers all built to a standardized pattern or design?
No, they conformed to the ground. At one stage during the Battle of Kohima, I was asked to fly over the Japanese positions in an Auster, and it was quite interesting. You could see where the British positions ended, because there were sort of bits of tin and, you know, washing and things, and then there was nothing. You couldn't. They would have covered over their tracks. And they realized we were so superior in artillery and air power that they took the very greatest pains to conceal themselves. And indeed, years later, when they came to York, I talked to Nishida, who was a battalion commander after Kohima, and I asked him about this, and he said, well, we realized we were going to be inferior in artillery and air. And so we did all our training entirely by night. We concentrated on that.
Did the construction of these bunkers follow certain clear principles then, if they didn't follow a single design or pattern?
I honestly couldn't answer that question. I don't think so. having taken a Japanese position on Aero Dura, used it as brigade headquarters and spent four nights in a Japanese bunker. And it was a big one, it was a command bunker. We used it as brigade command post. One remembers what it was like. The thing I remember most of it was getting lice in it. But no, I wouldn't have said they were done in any special way. What they were very good at was sighting them in support of each other. In other words, if you attacked one lot of bunkers, you might be quite certain, if it was possible, that you would be shot up from the rail, from the flank, from another lot of bunkers that you probably weren't aware about because you hadn't seen them.
What sort of thickness of overhead cover would a bunker normally have?
some cases sort of 4 to 6 foot. I mean, they were very deep down. I mean, medium shells, 5 foot penetrate.
Were they normally for single individuals or for small groups?
You had as they developed them, they developed almost, as I'm told the Vietnamese did later on, underground sort of warrens. And you could get from one bunker to another without exposing yourself.
Tunnel systems.
Tunnel systems, indeed.
Well, this sounds like it conforms to the old 18th century principle of having firing positions.
Sorry?
This sounds like it conforms to the old 18th century principle of having firing positions connected by a covered way. Or
correct.
Passages.
Yes. And they were particularly good, you see, the overhead cover was so good that they had no hesitation whatsoever in calling their own mortars and guns down on their own positions when you attacked them.
You said that one of the answers you developed to this sort of fortification was the pole charge.
Yes.
It strikes me the difficulty of being getting close enough to the bunker to employ the pole charge if it was on the 12-foot pole. How did you manage to contrive that? What tactics did you apply?
We used an awful lot of smoke. And it was sort of crawling along the ground, basic infantry tactics, to try and get somewhere where you could get at the bunker slit, if you could find where the bunker slit was.
Did they clear fields of fire in front of their bunkers?
Yes. But not so that their field craft was so good that it didn't necessarily direct you accurately to where the bunker was.
You couldn't use that as an indicator?
No. It really was very, very difficult. What you could do, and we did occasionally, was to try and draw their fire by night, in the hopes that you would see the flashes of the machine guns, and then, pinpoint them by compass, and then try and work out by day where the actual thing was.
How would you draw their fire? How would you?
Oh, by being beastly, sort of shooting at them or moving or something. Yes. And that was, of course, that was their tactic too for us. Bill Slim's great adage was, "The answer to noise is silence." It was almost a crime to shoot at night without having a corpse to show for it next morning.
Besides the pole charge, were there any other tactics that you used?
Well, yes, the pit, the infantry, that was used quite successfully. We even sort of wheeled 6-pounders up to the front line and had a go with them. But that was a fairly dangerous performance because a 6-pounder was not an easy thing to hide.
How close would you have to get to employ a 6-pounder in that sort of role?
100 yards, 150 yards. One was in very, very close contact.
Did they use a lot of mines and wire to...
No.
Approaches.
Thank heavens, they used homemade mines of grenades stuck in jam tins. The mines came later, by which time I'd left and I was at home. The mines came later when we went into Burma. There's stories of them digging holes in the road and putting one small Japanese soldier with a dirty shell and a hammer, waiting for the tank to drive over it. And those are absolutely true. So there was a shortage, generally speaking, of mines, and also a shortage of wire.
Had the people in 6th Brigade managed to develop these tactics before they fell back out of the Arakan?
No. Well, they had. The story of Sugar Five, which was the main defensive position, which was almost the last of the line before Achaeab, where everything went wrong. It started off by being attacked by a platoon. As I said, then it was a company, then it was a battalion. And then I think Bill Slim hotly protested, but he wasn't in command. He was in. They used, I think, six tanks. And he said, six, you want a regiment, you know. It took quite a long time before we had any real idea as to how we could deal with the Japanese ideas of defence.
Did you conduct experiments at Ahmednagar?
Yes, we did. We built Japanese bunkers. We took over a large sort of area which we cleared, and we actually built Japanese bunkers and tried out all sorts of means, including flamethrowers, tanks, to see the best way that we could deal with this. That was mostly done by our engineers.
And was the pole charge the best way?
It was one of the. It was a good way. You've seen the Kohima picture, haven't you? You've seen the sergeant of the Dorsets with his pole charge going forward. The pole charge, providing you could get up to it. The best way, of course, was a tank 75.
How close would a tank have to get in order to put a 75 into it?
In some cases, sort of 20, 30 yards.
Did the Japanese have effective anti-tank weapons?
In some cases, yes. They had, I never saw it, they had anti-tank shells, mounting guns, which they used effectively. They also had gas bombs. There are one or two occasions. This again was not Kohima. I never saw that. But our stories of gas bombs, which I think were sort of glass bottle things filled with cyanic gas, which they would throw into the engine louvre and get sucked in the thing.
Were they effective against tanks?
They were only used about twice, I think. I would have to go and look it up in the book, Louis Allen's book. But yes, they were effective. The trouble was, to be effective, a soldier had to get within 15 yards of the tank.
Presumably come out into the open to throw the bomb.
Yes.
What about flamethrowers? Were they generally effective as a method of clearing these bunkers?
I, oddly enough, took the first flamethrower up to Garrison Hill. For the Royal Welsh. But providing you had, they were horrid bloody things to carry about, and dangerous, but provided you could get within range of the fire. Yes, the flamethrower was effective. We also had flamethrowers mounted on Bren carriers. But the trouble was to get the Bren carrier anywhere near where you wanted the flamethrower. I don't know whether we ever had any flamethrowers on tanks like they had in North West Europe.
If you had a man-packed flamethrower, what sort of range would that achieve? How close would you have to get?
25 yards, 30 yards. Yeah.
It's often said that the flamethrower has a much more powerful effect on morale than other weapons.
Oh, I'm sure that's true.
Work with the Japanese as well?
Well, as I say, the only time I remember being used, we were horribly defeated. We got into a most frightful mess, and that was on the ridge at Kohima.
Were there any methods that you tried out at Amagnaga that didn't work, that were being used on an experimental basis, just as a...
Not that I can think of. No, that was about it.
What was the main syllabus of training carried out at this battle school at Ahmednagar? What were you trying to inculcate as a...
Well, one held various courses. First of all, there were what I might call the divisional courses, where the senior officers, by which time we had, by the time the battle school was really going, we had 33 corps formed, which was both 2nd and 36th divisions. And we were basically due to carry out seaborne landings. And so General Stopford and who was commander? Huey Stockwell commanded 36th, and they were there on demonstrations, courses, and discussions for senior officers. Not very many of those, but one would get people from other divisions who had been fighting Japanese and talk about these things, and talk about tactics, and you know, best way of supplying people and so on. But the main courses were for platoons, really, platoons and companies, where you got selected characters from the battalion and you had them for a fortnight and you tried to simulate the sort of life that they would lead. This is all on the experience of 6th Brigade and other people. And we did one hell of a lot of training at night. Relieving people in position, patrolling, and again trying to imitate the sort of noises, because the Japanese were adept at making noises to try and draw your fire. So you tried to get hold of these chaps and say, "Now, this is the sort of thing you're going to hear. It's not a bird, this is a human being, you know, and all the rest of it. And for goodness sake, don't be fooled by it."
How long would such a course take?
They were usually a fortnight.
Were they out in the jungle most of that time?
Well, no, because this was at Ahmednagar. One had scrub, yes. You could... it's rather like tactical warfare without troops, you know. You have jungle warfare without jungle. But it was, you see, one of our problems was, it's even worse today, so few of our soldiers had ever actually been alone at night. There was always a street lamp or glow, something in the sky. Well, now, you had to get them used to nothing except moonlight. And you had to get them accustomed to feeling at home in that, being able to use their weapons in that, being able to fire their mortars without sort of, you know, vast uses of torches and things to give them away, being able to resupply themselves. To go on patrols, and you're up against the whole business of psychology of the guy who has not lived in the country, who has never really been on his own at night, to get him accustomed to do it.
How long would it take the average soldier to become accustomed to working at night and...
I couldn't tell you that. You see, I mean, we at the battle school trained, as it were, the leaders, the sergeants and corporals and young officers and so on. That carried on when they went to their battalions. I don't think I could possibly tell you, because, of course, people vary. Some people take to it like a duck to water.
Were there any that you came across who just couldn't get used to the idea of that sort of night life and activity?
No. I don't think they liked it necessarily, but that was the life they led, you know. And it wasn't just the battle school, it was when they went back to their hotels.
Who actually played the part of enemy for these exercises?
Oh, we had our own, I can show you my battle school team. The instructional staff, as it were, apart from the officers, I had a whole company of Norfolks. I had a section of engineers. I had a battery of 837 howitzers from 99 Field Corps Armour. So we had quite a considerable staff of people to lay on demonstrations, act as enemy, generally keep the thing going.
You said that at night you would simulate the sort of noises the Japanese made.
Yes.
To try and draw fire. Did you manage to train the Norfolks to behave as the Japanese would have behaved?
Well, we tried to, yes. There was one exercise, for example, where we had a prepared position, British type, with foxholes in some scrub, and we would take the students after dark and do a relief in the line. They would have been briefed, as they would have been in real life, as to, you know, who they're up against, and they were just going to do a relief in the line and stay there until the exercise was over. And so you waited until it got dark, and you marched them forward just as they would do tactically. They relieved their chums in the trenches, and they set their guards and pickets and so on. And then we had, for example, a section of Vickers guns representing enemy machine guns, specially laid, that would fire tracer bloody close over their trenches.
On fixed lines?
Oh, yes, yes. You would have people who simulated Japanese calls. You would have... See, it's very interesting. They didn't... Sometimes they would know what units were in the line, and you would, in Japanese, you would say, we know your language of fusiliers, you know, you realize you're commanding over. You know, almost conversations going on to try and draw people's fire.
Psychological warfare, that is, isn't it?
That was psychological, yes. 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 And you had sort of crackling of twigs. You had, in the background, you had a fire of someone sort of obviously brewing up in a trench. You tried to make it as real as possible.
Did you get to know your Norfolks well, the soldiers in that demonstration?
Oh, yes, very well.
Now, the Norfolks generally, as I understand it, recruited primarily from the county of Norfolk and also from London.
Yes.
To get a balance. Did you find that the country boys from Norfolk were better at this kind of night work than the chaps from
London? No, I couldn't pin it down to battalions. Within a battalion, I could certainly pin it down to regiments.
Ah.
For example, I personally thought the best battalion we had in 2nd Division was the Downright Infantry, who took the most incredible casualties, never budged an inch. For what you might call dark and dirty work at night, Camerons, because they were, you know, came from the country, and Royal Scots, same. Your Norfolks and Dorsets were what I would call the typical British infantry who never gave up. you could be absolutely sure of them.